Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are a married couple who between them have brought musical joy to Irish people over the past five decades. Phil Coulter is from Derry and his wife Geraldine Brannigan is from Dublin. They met almost 40 years ago and have six children together. Phil is touring Ireland this month and next with Geraldine as his special guest. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Listen, let's just start off, Phil Coulter, with some of your songs. I was looking at the names of some of them. Puppin' on a String, Congratulations, The Town I Love So Well, My Boy, Steal Away, Score Not His Simplicity in Ireland's Call. All yours.
Yeah, that's a few.
If you'd written one of them, it would be something, you know, that people would remember you forever.
My first publisher told me years and years ago that one swallow doesn't make a summer and one song doesn't make a songwriter. After we won the Eurovision with Puppet on a String in 1967, to be honest, I got a rush of blood to the head. I thought, that's it, I've cracked it now, you know, my successful songwriter. Until our publisher called us in and said, well, guys, wait a minute, get a grip, you know. Like, a songwriter is somebody who writes songs, not somebody who goes to parties and, you know, wears sunglasses and hopes he's going to bump into Paul McCartney and John Lennon, which was really the kind of what we thought we were playing at being songwriters. So he took us in very seriously and said, you better knuckle down here and write some songs, you know, because the industry is beginning to think that you guys are a flash in the pan. I remember that hurt very deeply. So when we left that meeting, I thought, well, we'll show this bugger now just that we're not a flash in the pan. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll win the Eurovision again this year. And we very nearly did with Congratulations. But, you know, it's a good lesson to learn. You can't call yourself a songwriter with one hit.
Where did you both meet, Geraldine? Where did you first meet Phil?
To be honest, of all the questions you could ask, I think really that Phil should answer this because it has to do with the Eurovision.
Well, what's your memory of it?
My memory is I was doing a gig with my brothers up in Carrickmacross, long before there were mobile phones. And when I got back, I got a phone call. It was, I don't know, it was about like 1 o'clock in the morning. And I was told by my brother that Phil Coulter was looking for me. And I said, Phil Coulter. And then he gave me a whole litany of who he was, the ledge and all of that. I thought, because he was here worshipping, he was older than me, total. And so I was to contact Phil in Jury's Hotel the following day. And so I rang Mr. Coulter and I was shaking like a leaf because now I was told all the songs he'd written and I was just terrified. So to ring Mr. Coulter, and it was to do with coming out to the house, and he wanted to have a chat and hear me sing, and it was to do with the Eurovision. And back in those days, most people only had one TV and MTV didn't exist.
Yeah.
So everybody would watch the Eurovision Song Contest because it was credible back in those days, you know. He'd seen me in a commercial. He was told that I was a great little singer and whatever. So he came out to meet me and I nearly died. He was carrying the milk at the front door. And,
well, there was two milk bottles on the doorstep. I remember that.
Bit of a spark took place there.
Tell me, from your view, you needed a singer, was it, for the Eurovision?
Yeah, I'd been asked by the country of Luxembourg, because my track record in Eurovision was pretty good, having won in 67 with Puppet on a String, come second with Congratulations in 68, and then in 70, I published and produced and arranged Dana's All Kinds of Everything and kind of rejigged the song a bit. So that was like a first, a second, and a first in a 3 or 4 year period. Luxembourg is a small country, you know. I mean, Luxembourg, the country, is about the size of Bray, but it has an influence. Mm-hmm. It has an influence in music, particularly in Europe, because of RTL, Radio Télé Luxembourg. So have radio and television that goes through all of Europe, and they had a great track record in Eurovision for the simple reason that they would invite a French singer and to find a songwriter, or vice versa, or a German or a Dutch or whatever. So they cherry picked around Europe. So they asked me to write the song and find the singer to represent Luxembourg. And that was, we'd done some auditions in the UK and didn't really find anybody that I thought had a shot. And then I spotted Geraldine on TV on a Guinness ad, and I thought, well, definitely she has the voice and she has the look. And that was it. And then I arrived at her front door with the milk bottles. Six kids later, Miriam, what can I tell you?
So was it a spark at first sight?
I'm afraid so.
It was, yeah. Yeah. He was the most unlikely man that I'd ever fancy on my dad. Sorry about that, Phil.
Why do you know?
Well, I went for men my own age to start with. And they were usually like a kind of a Brad Pitt lookalike or pretty gorgeous. So I fell for sort of a bearded, sort of, but a very talented man.
Yeah, incredibly talented.
It was love at first sight. It was extraordinary. Yeah, it was amazing.
And what was the name of the song?
The song was, had to be in French just to complicate the issue further.
Yeah.
And I wrote it with a French songwriting friend of mine called Pierre Coeur, who had written a monster song called Love is Blue, L'amour est bleu. And so he did the French lyrics.
So can you imagine having to sing in French? And I was used to singing with my brothers at this stage. What, this was 1974. And I was out of school about 4 years, and I was only used to singing in bars, which was fine. I was on the up. My career was going great, and I had done a lot for RTE, a lot of television shows at that stage, and I'd been on the Late Late and all. But I was only used to singing in pubs and, doing the odd dance. My God, and suddenly I had to sing in, live in front of a huge audience and sing in French. And Pierre Coeur, who had written Love is Blue, I mean, it was terrifying. And he was so old at the time and very strict and get it right. And oh,
but you did very
God.
Well. Where did you come?
I came fourth.
Fourth. Wow.
Which was great in those days. And
yeah, I'll tell you,
I was able to sing in Europe.
Let me tell you, if Ireland could come fourth in the Eurovision Song Contest now, there'd be the big jubilation.
Well, it also meant it did give me a career, so it was amazing.
We're going to listen actually to a little bit of you singing Toi.
Endormi en écoutant ta voix, en oubliant ma vie au creux de toi, au creux de toi. Je me suis réveillée, j'ai retrouvé ta voix et je savais aimer. Dis-moi pourquoi, dis-moi pourquoi.
My God, it's amazing. I'm so overcome.
You are overcome.
Oh my God.
Why, Geraldine?
I'm just there. I'm just back there. It's, my God, it's incredible.
I haven't heard that for years.
It's just, it was the most incredible time of my life. But I was so in love and I was so overcome by the Eurovision. It meant the world to me. It was such an honour. It was incredible for a girl singer. You're singing in just pubs. I was so proud. And to be honest, it sounds silly nowadays because the Eurovision isn't the same, but sorry about that.
Is it that I recall such happy memories it makes you sound?
Yeah, God, I can see myself going out onto the stage and it's just incredible.
We haven't heard that for years.
No, I haven't
that's
heard it for years.
That's a real surprise.
I can see the dress, the white chiffon dress I wore and everything. My God, it's just incredible. Wow. Incredible.
Did you feel incredibly proud of her that night as well? Because you were conducting.
It was spectacular in every sense. Yeah, it was a great adventure. Absolutely great adventure. And as Geraldine says, it was not only was it spectacular and glamorous, and it had a great relevance in the music industry.
ABBA had won the previous year, and it was it was huge.
That's right. Yeah, ABBA had won the previous year.
It was in Sweden.
I mean, that's
in their country. Yeah.
It would have been massive.
And you had a full orchestra. It was a real sense of an event.
And the first half, Phil will tell you, the first half of Eurovision, I mean, I'm not good at the French, but it was Luxembourg, Dupont, and it was all of that the whole time. It was extraordinary,
At the halfway mark, we were winning.
Yeah.
At the halfway mark, we were
outright winners. And of course, then I think there was a bit of politics, from that point of view.
Beautiful voice, though. Where did your musical dreams come?
Well, I didn't come from a showbiz family, and I came from an ordinary middle class family living in Clontarf. Mum was just a homemaker, but she had been in the school of music, and Daddy played the piano. I don't know, Phil, did he play it well? But
he was okay.
You know, he'd play in the golf clubs for his friends and the usual. You know, we came from a musical family.
He was dudley on a sing-song, PJ.
Yeah, but that's where it began and ended. And, like, in actual fact, a funny story, if I may say so. I'm not great at chatting, but my first big career move was with Shea Healy. And we were going up to Donegal. And Donal Declan and myself were heading up there. And this was our first professional gig. We were getting, I think, £20 for the night. That's a lot of money. Mm. You know, I had spent already buying fabrics to make some dresses for the next few gigs. But anyway, we were going up to Donegal. And my father caught my younger brother going out the door. Declan was only 16 at the time. And he said, get back in there, young fella. So that was the end of that. We were now suddenly, we're down to a duo, our first professional gig. And we still went to Donegal.
Tell me this, did you still get the 20 quid from Shea?
I did. We did,
yeah,
I should say.
Shay's too good
so,
not
yeah,
to give
it
to
you. That was the start of it. But we used to sing at home, and the last year or so of myself being in school, I was in Manor House in Raheny, and my brother Donal was very musical, and he'd been on Shawshank, August Bartley and stuff like that when he was younger, and he used to play the guitar. So he said, Gerald, let's, you know, get a few songs, and you never know, we might enter a talent competition. And there was a huge competition in Finglas, and we won it outright. And then we found ourselves a manager, and they were coming out of the woodwork, and that actually set us on the path.
When you brought home Phil to meet your family, did they like him?
Ah, they did. You know, they did. They did, but they were a bit worried because he was a bit older than me. And, you know, there was a few hurdles and bumps and lumps like everybody has in life to sort of sort out first and that. But they knew he loved me. And that was the main thing. He didn't really have to prove himself, you know.
So, in fact, although you met in 75, you didn't get married until the 90s,
was
it?
It was because I had been married before, and at that time, you know, divorce wasn't something that you could avail of as readily as you can today. So it took a lot of time and a lot of navigation before we got to that stage.
Was it important to get married?
It was important. Look, we're Irish Catholics at the end of the day. Okay, yeah. We did a kind of...
We took our time.
Yeah. And
your father gave you away, didn't he?
He did, you know. I mean, it was crazy. He brought me down the stairs and handed me over to Phil. I mean, he was very proper and I adored him very much. It was important for me to complete things for Mammy and Daddy, you know.
And of course, 1975, it's like a different world, really. The Ireland we live in today, lots of people get divorced and remarry. But in 1975, it was unusual, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a different country.
So, yeah.
For sure.
Very much so. It took a while. And in fact, Georgina, our youngest, she had no teeth at the time. She was six when we got married. She's the youngest. I had 6 and 7 years. And, you know, Georgina said to the press the day we got married, she said, I told Daddy when was he going to marry Mummy? And in fact, when it was all very warm, and I mean, the whole country were behind us. They were delighted because, you know, it was a nice story.
But as Geraldine said, when we finally did it, when we were flying to Rome with the six kids, the people on the plane, the pilot congratulated us, and people were coming up from the back and saying, there was one little, I remember
two little,
little old dear, she
bumped in. Nuptials.
Congratulations on your nuptials.
It was so sweet.
On your nuptials, yeah. It was great. But then we arrived in Rome, and we had organised through the hotel a guide with a minibus. And he had obviously learned his English in night school, you know, and he was very diligent, sort of very handsome guy.
Beautiful,
wasn't he?
Yeah.
But anyway.
Heathcliff or something he was called.
That was his name, Heathcliff, yeah. Very, very typical Roman name. But anyway, he said, Signor Coulter, you come to Rome on holiday? I go, no, I said, we're here on honeymoon. And he looks at the back and sees the six kids. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to figure, I could see this kind of look of puzzlement on his face.
What kind of a tourist
and he's,
this,
yeah, he's kind of looking back on his on the English lesson when the word honeymoon came up. And he thought, surely that is when you just get married. And he's looking at the six kids. He doesn't know how this all fits out. People don't bring six kids on honeymoon. But we did.
Sweet.
And that was crazy.
Your dad is no longer alive, Jane, but your mum will be listening this morning, won't
she? Oh, she will, absolutely. Mum is 89. You know, her health is not great, but up here she's 100%.
Well, she's bright as
great,
a button.
Great sense of humour.
Granny, yeah.
She's wicked. She means the world to me. Yeah.
I know your mum loves one particular song you used to sing, the Carly Simon one.
Oh, she does. Nobody does it better.
Do you want to sing it now or we get Carly to do it?
Get Carly to do it.
Give Carly a break.
Very good.
Okay, for your mum this
Thank
morning,
you.
We're going to listen to Carly Simon.
makes me feel sad for the rest. Nobody does it half as good as
That's for your mom, Geraldine.
Oh, thank you so much.
Great song.
She'll be thrilled.
Proper song, proper singer, proper record.
Yeah, you know, fantastic.
Records today sound as if they were made in the bathroom, and a lot of them were. You know, somebody said, with the new technology, the good news is everybody can make a record. The bad news is everybody is making a record.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Tell me about, I know it's Derry, obviously, but what was your own background and how did you get into music?
Well, music was definitely part of the fibre life in Derry. I mean, I can remember growing up in Derry when in very modest houses, a piano would have been more important than a three-piece suite. You know, those were the days when people entertained themselves and sing songs and big nights, you know, were very much part of it. And in our neighbourhood, our kind of street, it would have been the Coulter's house. It would have been the venue for these kind of parties and whatever. So I grew up with music not only as an academic subject or something that, you know, that you'd listen to in church on a Sunday or in the annual fete, but it was part of life. There was a feel-good thing about music because I associated with live music being played in the parlour, you know. So
what did your dad work in?
My dad was a cop. He started off as a cop on the beat.
In the RUC?
In the RUC.
A Catholic?
Yeah.
That's unusual.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was in the minority, certainly. Mm. And then he went through the ranks and got as far as detective sergeant. That would have been as far as he would have been allowed to go as a Catholic back in those days. You see, in those days, Miriam, there was a kind of amongst the nationalist Catholic community, there was a sort of an acceptance, you know, that that's the way things are, you know. There was an acceptance of the fact that there was gerrymandering in the voting. There was acceptance of the fact that that the jobs, you know, any kind of government job, you know, they were always leaned towards the unionist community, etc. That was the way it was. Years later, when we talked about it, said that, you know, he had five kids and, you know, he had a job that was a respected job. And he felt that he was, you know, playing an important role in the community. He had a pensionable job that afforded him to educate his kids and stuff, you know. But luckily, that was in an era before the balloon went up, you know, in 1969, 70, then on. I mean, I was very glad that my dad had retired from the RUC and then and wasn't in the front line, you know, in Duke Street or any of that.
What's interesting, though, John Hume, of course, who loves to sing A Town I Love So yeah. Well, one of your songs, yeah. He grew up and obviously went the path of peace. But other people who grew up in that kind of environment didn't. They turned to violence. Yeah. What protected you? Was it music that you didn't react against the system?
Well, probably that. You know, there's nobody in Derry who's not politically aware, you know. And although I chose music, it's not to say that I was I wasn't aware of what was going on or political, you know, with a small p. I went to Queen's, you see, in Belfast. I left Derry when I was 17, 18, and then immediately after Queen's, I went to London. So I was kind of removed. You know, I wasn't in the eye of the hurricane as that was happening in the 70s. But, you know, had I been in Derry, as a lot of my friends, contemporaries were, and on Bloody Sunday, for example, you know, Bloody Sunday was the biggest recruitment drive that the Provos ever had.
Really?
Oh, for sure, yeah. For sure, because people were incensed, you know, people were outraged. I mean, if internment was seen as a travesty, I mean, Bloody Sunday was just like, you know, it was out and out murder. In fact, you know, there's a loose end that has only been tied up in recent times, you know, without apology for Bloody Sunday. For a lot of Derry people, that was unfinished business. You know, and there couldn't really be any forward movement until that got tidied up.
You, of course, went to St. Columb's, that school in Derry.
Yeah.
Name all the people who've been there.
Well, about 10 years before me, Brian Freel would have been there then. In my era, it would have been John Hume, Seamus Heaney. Slightly after me would have been Paul Brady. Eamon McCann was in my era. Fergal Sharkey of the Undertones.
It's an incredible school.
Yeah, yeah.
Did it encourage you all to be free thinkers? I mean, what is the secret of that school?
No. Free thinking didn't come into it at all. What they encouraged us to be was hard workers. It was a work ethic thing, you know. When I've talked about it with any of the aforementioned luminaries, the one thing we agree on that what St. Columb's taught us was that if you had a talent or if you had ability, you had an obligation to do something about it, to work at it. Not because this was some kind of moral issue, but there was a practical side to it as well. And that was in the late 40s, the Labour government in the United Kingdom introduced an Education Act, which opened up third level education to scholarship. So we were taught at St. Columb's, this is your shot. You know, if you've got the brains, if you've got the talent, you've got to work at it. Get yourself a university scholarship. Aspire to third level education, which maybe none of your family had ever aspired to before. In my case, my eldest brother, Father Joe, had, because he'd been to Maynooth. But, you know, for our generation and our community, getting to university was a big, big adventure.
Was it a big worry then for your parents that having got to university, you, in their eyes, maybe gave it up to be a musician, a songwriter?
Oh, I think they were in total despair. I think they were very close to calling the parish priest in and coming to have me exorcised, you know. I mean, they couldn't figure out where, having made all of those sacrifices. I was a good student, you know, I was bright. I got my university scholarship, I got a state exhibition, and I was, you know, academically bright. But I got infected with a music disease, and that was it, you know. I mean, I wanted to go to London and try my hand at being a songwriter. My mother, God rest her soul, I'm sure she was saying decades of the rosary, all of those years, thinking that I was either burgling houses or stealing hubcaps or something to make a living. She couldn't figure out how anybody could make a living from that jazz music, as she called it, you know. So when I won the Eurovision Song Contest, for me, the sweetest moment of all of that was when the mayor of Derry, the unionist mayor of Derry, granted me a civic reception, which in fact was like standing around the mayor's parlour for a half an hour and drinking a glass of dry sherry. No big deal, you know, but it was a huge deal to my mum and dad because they sent the mayor's car up to our little terrace house.
Suddenly it was credible.
Yeah, yeah, with a chauffeur and a cap and everything.
Wow.
You know, and all the neighbours were looking out and waving, you know, it was a big
thing.
That
was a big
thing. So, yeah, so I thought, well, at last, you know, my folks now can figure out that, you know, at least I can make a living from this game.
And Geraldine, when you went into music as a career, did you think that would be your career forever? You could make your living out of that?
Well, initially I wanted to, my last year of school, I was going to the art college once I left school, but things changed and we did well that last year. So I went into the business and we sort of crept into it and that was it. I never looked back. But my parents, my father, it took a while, but they became very proud of us. And then, of course, 3 years later when I got the Eurovision, I mean, that was huge.
You stopped playing and touring for a long time, didn't you, when your children were younger?
Yeah, I mean, I worked professionally for 16 years and then I decided I was going to start having a family. It was hard because I was having huge number one hits and number one albums that Phil had produced, and he'd written loads of songs for me for South Africa. So I gave it up at the top, which was really, really hard. Mm. But it was a decision I was glad that I made. But having said that, a year later, after having my first baby, Danielle, the record company in South Africa said, come down and do a promo. And I did 94 concerts in 10 weeks. And that was after the first baby. So I had given it up and then I was back in for a year later, I should say. And then I was expecting my second baby a year later, Dominique. I was 3 months pregnant and I was getting ready and, you know, rehearsing with the band. And unfortunately, I was losing the baby. So I was told, if you keep going, you really will lose the baby. So that was more important. So I gave it up completely then. But moving on 16 years later, you know, the big show band show that's on every year, which is hugely successful. And it's David Hall up in the north. And he was looking for a girl singer, somebody new, because, you know, they'd had all the usual entertainers for years. It's been running. So Tony Kenny, actually, fair play to him, mentioned it to my brother and he'd said it to David Hall that you know, maybe Geraldine Branigan might do it. So I committed myself to doing it and then I thought nobody will remember me and oh my God, it's a big mistake. So I did it. It was a huge success and all my confidence came back. I realised I had a woman's voice compared to 16 years ago when it was still a girl's voice.
Do you sing together at home?
Well,
When there are sing songs, you know,
yeah.
when there's drink on the job, when drinks
but we're not sitting like in the parlour.
Those days are
way
gone. Party or
something. Oh, absolutely.
God, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, try and keep us from sitting down. Are you kidding? I mean, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Would you sing something for us now?
I think we might. Yeah. Will we do The Waters Wide?
Waters Wide sounds like a nice idea.
Okay, this is something I recorded years ago and I love the song, so we'll do that.
That was was really lovely. Come back over. Your voice is still very beautiful, Geraldine.
Thank
you have
you,
not
sweetheart.
Lost it.
I appreciate that.
Really nice yeah, song.
You.
Did you write that?
Didn't write that song. One of many great songs that I didn't write. I'm afraid.
So you're looking forward now going on tour together again?
Yeah, we're all over the
country. It'd be like the old days.
I know, it's great. Yeah. Get out the transit wagon.
And the great thing
not
is,
quite.
The great thing is it's in those... We probably couldn't have done this tour like 10 years ago because a lot of the theatres didn't exist. You know what I mean? We're everywhere from Ballymaloe, Navan, Limerick.
Bray,
hometown. Of course, Wexford, Kilkenny, Sligo, Dublin, Waterford, Ennis,
everywhere.
Burr.
God, you have a great memory, Phil.
Great memory. I'm reading it off. We're going to go right through until the 17th of March.
Is it great you can work with your husband and not kill each other?
Yeah. Do you find it good working together?
Absolutely. Because, I mean, no matter what, we could have a disagreement at home like any normal family.
No.
But, you know, about furnishings, what we're having for dinner tonight. No, I don't want that. I want fish instead. All those kind of silly things. But when it comes to work, that's a whole different ballgame. I'm just back in my comfort zone completely. And Phil knows it. He knows he can work with me, shall we say.
It's very civilized, you know, and we're on the road together. And it's kind of cozy, you know.
And we have a laugh even on the road, you know. We have our driver that takes us in the Jeep, and we have a bit of crack, and it's great fun, really, you know.
You know, you make the most of it. I get very impatient with people and younger people in the music business who complain about having to, you know, all long drives and this, that, and the other, and one nighters and blah blah. You know. It's a privilege to be able to make a living from music, you know. I mean, for us, it's something we never lose sight of. For me, having done it for 45 years, I think I'm, you know, to be able to make a living, from your talent and something that you love to do, is a rare gift.
Just before the break, we have been talking a bit about your roots in Derry, and we're going to take a song now, Phil, which I think you wrote for your dad.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
My dad was a big influence, obviously. He was from County Down and played the fiddle. Not particularly well. I mean, you know, he wasn't orthodox. He played by ear. And my mother played the piano, also by ear. Their party piece would have been playing together. My father would have been playing the fiddle, jigs and reels. And my mother would have been vamping along, usually in a different key from when my father was playing it. But you know, the fact that they enjoyed doing it, and it was the joy of music, which I learned from them. But, the song about my dad is a song which... what I like about this song is that there's hardly a week goes by when I don't get a note or, in these days, an email from people to say that they've just buried their dad, and at the funeral they played this song. So it has come to mean a lot to people around.
Interestingly, we had Martin McHugh with his son Mark on recently, and they chose this song as well as one of their requests.
And that's very flattering.
So you go over there now and you're going to sing The Old Man.
The tears have all been shed now. We've said our last goodbyes. His soul's been blessed. He's laid to rest. And as now, I feel alone.
Beautiful song. Everyone will dedicate it to their dad. Do you have a favourite song of his, Geraldine?
I love Steal Away, particularly. It's quite an emotional song, really. Don't you think, Phil?
Yeah.
I think it's beautiful. And I think the Furies did a great job on it.
You? It's impossible to ask you what your favourite song is.
Oh, no, it's not. No, I can answer that. I can answer that quite readily, The Town I Love So Well. You know, it may not be the most commercially successful song in terms of, like, dollars and cents earned, but it certainly would be the song that means most to me. To me, as Phil Coulter the man and Phil Coulter the dairyman. Let's put it like this. That's the song I would choose to be remembered for.
Tell me the story about how you wrote that song. It involves Lou Kelly as well, doesn't it, Phil?
When I took over producing The Dubliners, you know, I was coming off a string of hits in the charts. But Kelly, he was continually badgering me to write songs that would be, you know, songs that would address some kind of grown-up issues, you know, songs that would have some substance, some lyrical content that would go a little deeper than the songs I'd be writing for the Bay City Rollers, for example. So fast forward the tape now, and I'm in Derry on the very weekend that internment is introduced. And I shared the trauma of other Derry people at the kind of blunt instrument that internment was, where, you know, if you had a history in the GAA, if you spoke Irish, if you went to Irish dances, or if you were seen to have any nationalist kind of leanings, that was enough to drag you out of bed at 4 o'clock in the morning and throw you into prison. So there's a sense of outrage in Derry. And I wrote a song, probably my first political song, called Free the People, which was an anti-internment song. And because it was anti, you know, it was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. It's not a great song by any means, but it was off the moment. And I suppose, you know, opened up a kind of a highway to me to write songs that were a little bit more substantial, a little bit more personal than Congratulations or Puppet on a String. Having gotten my head into that kind of space, I suppose, you know, with the whole kind of anti-internment thing in that political arena, and then over a period of the next couple of years, seeing what was happening in Derry, I'd been horrified when I'd go back and see, you know, not only the physical damage on the landscape, but the kind of psychological damage to the people. And I thought this calls for a song.
And also, as an artist, whether you're a poet or a songwriter or a writer, I suppose, do you have to be very careful when you're in a situation, maybe when there is incredible violence, that your songs also aren't in some way an incitement?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think I wrote the tune of The Town I Love So Well probably within a couple of weeks. The words, however, took me a year, because I was aware that just with the wrong choice of words, the wrong choice of image, it could just have tipped over and become another rebel song, which was the very last thing that I wanted, and God knows the very last thing that we needed. So I had to be very careful about the imagery and very careful about the words.
I'd love to hear a little of that.
I will always see the town that I have loved so well, where our school played ball by the gas yard wall, and we laughed through the smoke and the smell. Going home in the rain, running up the dark lane, past the jail and down behind the fountain. Those were happy days in so many, many ways, in the town I loved so well.
Such a beautiful song. My favourite song of yours is Scorn Not His Simplicity. I do think that's a beautiful song. I know you wrote it about a young son from your first marriage who had Down syndrome.
That's a different exercise for a songwriter. You know, writing Puppet on a String, you're tailoring the song for Eurovision Song Contest. Writing Back Home for the England World Cup squad, I mean, you know that's a particular target. Writing Shang-A-Lang for the Bay City Rollers is a different target. When you start writing a song about your own experience, your own life, something important that has happened in your own experience, and you're kind of opening up, you know, private parts of your own psyche, of your own emotion, I find that difficult, you know. And it wasn't until months after my first son was born with Down syndrome that maybe is a part therapy, I suppose, as much as anything else, that I wrote Scorn Not His Simplicity. Because the first person I played it to was Luke Kelly, because I knew that this was the kind of thing that he was encouraging me to do. And had Kelly not been badgering me all that time to do that, I may never have had the courage to do it.
When you played it to him for the first time, sang it to him, was his reaction?
Well, I knew then, I knew by Kelly's reaction that it was, you know, that I had kind of crossed across that bridge. Because, you know, as with The Town I Love So Well, had it not worked, he would have been the first to say, no, this is too sentimental, or it's this, that and the other.
And interestingly then, he really wanted to record it, Luke, didn't he? And yet you'd think with Luke's voice, it wouldn't be the best song for Luke, and yet he does the most beautiful rendition of it.
The two best versions of Scar Not His Simplicity are two very, very different
Sinead
versions.
Sinead as well. Yeah.
Luke's, which is definitely very manly and very, you know, making a
powerful
statement, very powerful.
Yeah.
Kelly had great fire in his belly, you know what I mean? There's never been a voice like Luke Kelly, and there never will be another one. Kelly came from an era when singers growing up wanted to sing those kind of songs, you know. The kids now don't want to be Luke Kelly, they want to be Bono. You know, they want to be rock stars. And that's the difference. You know, the whole ballad thing has now changed. We're not producing those kind of singers anymore. Yeah, Kelly's version of Scar Not is the definitive version, but Sinead's brings the whole femininity
which is
very sensitive and, you know, very beguiling. I remember very well when we recorded that, I was producing an album with Sinead and we were going through material. The album was called Universal Mother. And we were going through songs that had that kind of theme and Scar Not His Simplicity came up. And Sinead was not aware that I wrote it. She was aware of the song and Luke Kelly's version, but she was not aware that I wrote it. So anyway, we recorded it, and I determined that we wouldn't use strings or any other distractions. We would just do the song as the song, piano and voice. And I persuaded the engineer just to dim the lights in the studio one night. She's in the vocal booth, I'm at the piano. We ran it through once just to get the kind of routine and get the mic levels, etc. Then we did a take. And when it finished and the last chord died, we both stayed exactly where we were for what seemed like an eternity, because we were both aware that something special had happened in the studio, and that doesn't happen every time you're in a studio.
See the child with the golden hair, yet eyes that show the emptiness inside. Do we know? Can we understand just how he feels, or have we really tried? See him now as he stands alone and watches children play a children's game. Simple child, he looks almost like yet they know he's not the same. Scar not his simplicity, but rather try to love him all the more. Scar not his simplicity, oh no.
What a beautiful version.
She has a stunning voice. In fact, do you not remember she recorded one of your songs, another song, The Shores of the Swilly?
Yeah, this is
and
a song.
And that's stunning as well. Amazing.
A song that I wrote on an album called Lake of Shadows, a song about Lough Swilly.
Mm. Is that because of your brother and sister?
Yeah. I mean, well, the Swilly, my life seems to be fated to be entwined with the Swilly, because some of my happiest memories are to do with the Swilly when we used to rent a little cottage at Lisfannan outside of Buncrana, when I was a kid, and played on the beach there with my two brothers and two sisters. We all learned to swim in that stretch of water. And then in many, many years later, in adult years, when both my sister and brother drowned in that same stretch of water. And on that album, I wrote a piece for my brother Brian called Farewell to Inishowen, and wrote this song for my young sister called The Shores of the Swilly. And even as I was writing it, I knew that Sinead was the voice that I wanted to sing it.
Do you find, therefore, if you write songs, that sometimes it can be a way of you dealing with incredible sadness and emotion in your life?
Well, for me, yeah. I mean, not everybody has that outlet, you know. And it certainly did help. You know, it doesn't solve the problem and it doesn't make it go away, but it just helps you to kind of find a place that you kind of store it away. And you know, occasionally that's a scar and a wound that'll still bleed occasionally, you know. But I mean, I remember particularly with Shores of the Swilly, just to revisit that whole episode, which had been particularly painful, did sort of help me put it in some kind of context, yeah.
Mm. And because you spoke so beautifully there about the shores of Lough Swilly and your brother and sister who tragically drowned in Lough Swilly, will you play that for us to close the programme? Well, the best of luck, Geraldine Brannigan and Phil Coulter. Thank you for being my guest today. Best of luck with all those concerts. Thanks on sound today to Mark McGrath, to my producer Eileen Heron. Thank you very much for listening. And Geraldine and Phil's tour continues right up until the 17th of March when they'll be playing the Hudson Bay Hotel in Athlone. And now, Phil, if you will sing us out with The Shores of Lough Swilly.
By the shores of the Swilly, two children at play, the king of the castle, the queen of the may, just me and my sister in a world of pretend, where the sun would keep shining and the day never end.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.